This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 9th of March 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here on Monocle 24 with me, Christian Yeo. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a year after Japan's devastating earthquake and tsunami, we speak to one of the Red Cross psychiatrists involved in the aftermath of the crisis.
Two main causes of stress. One is loss from the tsunami and the earthquake. Many people lost their families. Not only one, maybe their whole families lost.
And we hear about the rise of the super mosque with the architect of a new mosque planned for Cologne. And we meet another one of our Midori House neighbours. This time it's the deli and coffee shop Paul Rothen's son.
In fact, my father used to tell me that we were the third delicatessen in London. I don't know whether that's true, but he always told me that story.
All that, plus a tour of Berlin's culinary scene and a little bit of music as well. All that on today's Midori House with me, Christian Yeo. But first, let's get the news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The United Nations Syria Special Envoy Kofi Annan has called for an immediate end to violence in the country and stressed that the ultimate solution to the crisis lies in political settlement. Opposition leaders have condemned his call for dialogue with the government of President Bashar al-Assad, saying his comments were disappointing when Syrians were being massacred every day. But at a meeting of EU foreign ministers in Copenhagen today, the Swedish foreign minister Carl Bildt said a political solution had to be the focus.
Now it is primarily the search for political solution. If that's possible, remains to be seen. But to avoid the country and the entire region sliding into devastating sectarian war has to be the priority. And Kofi Annan and his mission is the centerpiece of what we are trying to do at the moment.
Moving from Syria to Iran now, and the UN nuclear watchdog believes that Iran may be trying to clean up a military site that inspectors want to visit as part of an investigation into possible Iranian research relevant to atomic bombs. Iran has refused access to the Parchin military complex southeast of Tehran during two rounds of talks with the senior team of the International Atomic Energy Agency in Tehran earlier this year. Western diplomats say Iran may be delaying inspectors' access to the site to give it time to sanitize the facility of any incriminating evidence of explosive tests that would indicate efforts to design nuclear weapons. The daughter of the jailed former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, Yevgenia, has arrived to visit her mother in prison today following growing concerns about the opposition leader's health. Tymoshenko used to be Prime Minister of Ukraine and is the arch-rival of the current Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. She's serving a 7-year jail sentence for abuse of office following a trial widely seen as a settling of scores between rival groups of influence in the ex-Soviet Republic. The United States and Afghanistan have signed a deal today on the transfer of a major US-run detention center to Afghan authorities, improving the prospects of a strategic partnership allowing long-term American involvement in the country. A senior American official said earlier this week that the transfer of the Bagram detention center would be a first step to handing over all US-managed prisons. John Allen, commander of NATO forces in Afghanistan, said that ties between the two countries were as strong as ever.
The men and women of the International Security Assistance Force, join me in reaffirming our commitment to the people of Afghanistan, to their sovereignty, to the rule of law, and to the ultimate transition of security responsibilities to the Afghan National Security Forces.
A video calling for the arrest of Joseph Kony, the fugitive leader of the Lord's Resistance Army militia group in Uganda, has swept across the internet this week. The 30-minute YouTube video has been viewed almost 40 million times, while tweets about Kony have become the number one trending topic worldwide on Twitter. A host of celebrities, including Angelina Jolie, George Clooney, Rihanna and Oprah, joined the virtual chorus of support for the cause at a Women's Day event in New York. Jolie expressed support for the video and urged the arrest of Joseph Kony for crimes against humanity.
I don't think I know anybody that doesn't hate Joseph Kony. And anybody who works in the international field has been aware, and I've been to Uganda and Congo and been to the International Criminal Court myself and spoken with with the chief prosecutor about the case, and he's the one that we all want to see in jail. So I think it's great that more people are talking about it.
And finally, Germany's best-selling Daily has decided to remove its trademark pictures of topless women from the front page in a gesture towards complaining readers. Bild, which sells about 4 million copies a day, will now carry the images on page 3 instead. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you for that, Jonathan. And it's 5 minutes past five in the morning of Saturday, 10th of March, 2012, if you're waking up in Sydney and Melbourne. And let's take a quick look at the papers that are landing on the kitchen tables of Australia and New Zealand. We start with the New Zealand Weekend Herald, which covers the court case of the Kiwi cricket star Chris Cairns, who's taken Lalit Modi to court for comments made on Twitter. It's the first of its kind. He's suing Modi for defamation over a tweet he sent alleging that Cairns had cheated on his wife. Both Cairns and his wife were in court in London today, which is where the trial's taking place. And the Weekend Herald observes that most of the makeup of people observing the trial today were media students and law students from the local universities in London. And I believe this went to print just before the culmination of proceedings today in London. But looking at it, Chris Cairns was actually ushered out of court after he became quite angry at the fact that Lalit would not be speaking today. So that's a trial ongoing at the moment, being covered all around the world, both in London and in New Zealand. Looking at the Saturday Age of Australia, there are calls for Baillieu's anti-corruption body to be axed. And it's toothless, according to critics. Baillieu's baby lacks bite. The scope of Victoria's landmark anti-corruption watchdog so narrow that the body should be abandoned. And looking at the Sydney Morning Herald, we look at the Reinhardt Empire and the war of words between the family. Of course, the children of Gina Reinhardt in a bitter row now over the future of the family's empire, with Ginia, the only child standing by her mother, against the other children who are after the family trust money. And Ginia has been accused of driving a $1.2 million car. Very nice if you can get it. It's 7 minutes past the hour here on Midori House. We'll be back just after the weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
The western half of Europe, good weather developing here at the moment, sunny and mild in Spain and Portugal. France and the UK will also have some sunshine as we head into the weekend. It's not the same everywhere though. In the Baltic, Eastern Europe, cloudy, rain, even some snow. And the South Mediterranean is looking stormy, especially around Sicily and Malta, even Tunisia. So the weekend city outlook, London, 15 degrees, some sunshine here. In Zurich, 8 degrees, but partly cloudy. Barcelona, a mild 17 with sunny skies. In St. Petersburg, it's zero and it'll be snowing. North America, nasty weather to end the week across the deep south of the US. Big thunderstorms here. A little Friday rain too on the Atlantic coast from DC to New England. But here on the eastern seaboard, the weekend is actually looking sunny. Texas, however, more thunderstorms in the coming days. The weekend city outlook, New York City, sunny but a little cool, around 12 degrees. In Chicago, it's 11 with sun and showers. Dallas, thunder showers and 18. And in Los Angeles, a cool down from Saturday's 23 degrees down to 15 degrees come Sunday. And just a reminder, the clocks are going forward 1 hour in the US this Saturday night, local time. Other parts of the world then, Mexico City, 25 degrees with sun and showers. If you're in Sao Paulo, it'll be 32, partly cloudy. But if you're off to Hong Kong, very disappointing next few days. Cool and wet, only 14 degrees, which is below average. However, in Sydney, pleasantly warm and sunny. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Thomas. It's 9 minutes past the hour here. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, much of the rubble and debris may be cleared away in communities across northeast Japan, hit hard by last year's earthquake, tsunami and nuclear disaster. But for hundreds of thousands still living in the region, there'll be little sense of optimism as the first anniversary of the disasters marked this Sunday. It's clear that for many, the psychological impact of the disaster will most likely take far longer to recover than the physical damage to the landscape. Dr. Toshiharu Makishima, the General Director of the International Medical Relief Department at the Japanese Red Cross, has been leading the organization's psychological care programs in the northeast of Japan for the past year. He explained to Monocle's Tokyo correspondent Danielle Dimitriou how people are still suffering and what steps need to be taken to recover.
First of all, the psychological programs closely related with the physical programs. Many people stay in the temporary houses in winter time. There's so much of snowfalls. They were locked inside the houses. And many elder people feel loneliness, separated from the other people or neighbors. Then the many people complain there are disturbance or the difficulty in sleeping. And also they feel very lonely because of the separated from the other people. Main problem is maybe the depression is most important and difficult problems. But I don't know how many people process their PTSD or some special style of the stress reactions. There were the two main causes of the stress. One is the loss from the tsunami and the earthquake. Many people lost their families, not only one. Maybe their whole families lost. But also the elongated displaced living or the life in the temporary shelter is another cause of the stress because of they are separated from the other people. Then many old people, they find nothing to do in their houses. They continue to drink alcohol every day. That's a big problem for them. How to cope with the stress is very difficult for them. The initial 2 months, the government make an assessment for the suicide rate in the affected areas. There was a 20% increase in the suicide rate in Miyagi and the Iwate prefectures. But I'm afraid that there may be more people try to suicide after the 1 year, because they cannot find the hope in their future. They suffering from the everyday stress, living in the temporary shelter without help. Many children suffer another stress from the difference of their situations. But usually the government supports the children through the school, elementary and junior high school, deploying the psychologist or the counselor to support the children. This is official support systems. But I think those teachers who should take care of those children should be trained or to be supported by the specialist, how to support the children in these situations. Community is the most important thing in this time. Because, you know, there was many temporary houses, just like a village or the small communities of the affected people. But some temporary houses, community, organized when the original village or the community moved into these temporary houses. That's very good because they already have their own supporting network or the systems. On the other hand, many temporary houses were gathered the affected people from the different areas. Then those people living in the temporary houses do not know the neighbors. Then, of course, there is no local community networks to support them to set up or build the local network.
What lessons do you feel may have been learned from that experience?
Yes, after the Kobe earthquakes, many people committed suicide, and also the many people lost their family members. They had a very hard time in temporary shelter without social support. Then we started our programs. But originally, our disaster response program is designed as an emergency phase support programs. But this time, so we realized the need for the long-term or recovery phase programs. Then we started our pilot program. We are just beginners for the recovery phase. Maybe the elderly people is the most vulnerable people in these times, because younger people can find a new way of life. For example, in affected areas, young people cannot find a job. Then they move to the big city or that other place to find a job and to find their start a new life. But elderly people cannot do that. They should stay in their homeland or the temporary houses.
What is the mood, the general feeling among people up there at the moment?
But many people do not want to remember the tsunami or the earthquake. Of course, it's very important to have the annual ceremony to put the some remark on the memory. But many people do not want to remember. If you put on the TV set, so many programs introduce the scene of the tsunami. Then I'm afraid that those TV programs evoke the new symptom of the stress in some Burma people.
Just finally, I was just going to ask how you personally feel about the future in the Northeast.
So many people can recover, of course, but there were the people who cannot recover or who cannot progress by themselves. But they have the power to make a progress. Then we should support them to let them find their own power to stand up again. That is our main task, to support the affected people.
That was Dr. Toshiharu Makishima of the Japanese Red Cross speaking to Danielle Demetria. It's time for a song now, and we're going to keep it Japanese right now. This is Cornelius with Star Fruits Surf Rider. Cornelius with Starfruit Surf Rider. In just a moment on Midori House, we'll be finding out about life for Iranians in Los Angeles, right after this.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune into The Curator every Sunday right here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest to the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
The menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks program with me, Markus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and sometimes weird tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, anyone with more than an hour to waste in front of the television will know full well that reality shows are something of a common denominator on most channels, be it high-end or low-end. These low-cost shows provide networks with relatively cheap laughter, whilst apparently shining a light on society. We've seen conniving corporate wannabes tread on each other on The Apprentice, and we've seen New Jersey's Italian-Americans parade themselves on Jersey Shore, providing novel additions to the public lexicon in the process. A new show, though, does much the same, this time delving into the lives of Iranian Americans in Los Angeles. With a community bulging at nearly 800,000, Tehranjali's, or the Persian Square as it's officially known, is the biggest collection of Iranians outside Iran itself. But not everyone's happy with Bravo's depiction of Iranians in Shahs of Sunset. Like most reality shows, it attracts the bold, the brash, the loud. It's prompted one Iranian novelist in Los Angeles to go public with her thoughts to rebalance the perception of Iranian Americans. Gina Nahai joins me on the line now. Gina, is it as bad as you say? I've heard the words vain, stupid, spoiled banded around by you. Is it that bad?
It is that bad, and it's that bad even compared to other reality shows, in the sense that it's really a spoof on a reality show, if it's even such a thing is even possible. I've only seen the first episode. I got an advanced screening of the first episode, but really, it makes you cringe just to look at these people.
You wrote a very humorous review of that first episode, and for those who haven't seen the Shahs of Sunset, describe the characters that it depicts.
Well, the cast, there are four main actors in the cast. There is a very heavy, unattractive woman who's who has no work and who lives in an apartment somewhere in Beverly Hills, and insists that she doesn't want to get married and walks around with her chihuahuas, a pair of chihuahuas in a pink stroller. She carries them around and takes them to hotels, to pet hotels. There is a gay man who keeps insisting that his masculine powers have a lot to do with the fact that he's Persian. There is another man who keeps talking about how Iranians don't work in buildings; they own the buildings. And every stereotype that unfortunately the American public has had about Iranians in this country, and especially in Los Angeles, has been exaggerated and reinforced, and then fed to these characters, who then spit it back out on the screen. And really, the problem is not that the show is inaccurate and not very well made at all. The problem is the reaction that we get, that we've already been getting from the American public, even before the show has aired. You see so much venting of anti-Iranian sentiments already in the media or on the internet, just because the show's about to air.
Of course. Gina, as you say, the timeliness of this show, at a time when there's somewhat of a standoff politically between the US and Iran. Could you not suggest, though, that this characterization of these Iranians as shallow and materialistic actually brings them in line with a lot of other Americans and other sections of society in the West, and it actually humanizes them and makes them seem more familiar to people in America?
Well, you know what it's like. There are shallow people or unintelligent people who everywhere, in every population. But if an American walks around talking about her Christian Louboutin shoes and how she's got to find a husband who's as rich as her father so she can keep buying these shoes, we think, well, this is a shallow individual. When a member of a minority says the same thing, the general public tends to blame the entire minority, tends to identify that person with the entire minority. And now, this, you know, Iran has been at loggerheads with America in one way or another for more than 30 years now. So the political situation has been bad enough consistently, but especially in Los Angeles, the hostility and antipathy that Americans have always, well, not always, but have held against the Iranians has only gotten worse over time.
Do you think the perception of this show in Iran, back in the homeland, will be particularly favorable? I would imagine not so.
No, it won't be. No, it won't be favorable at all.
How could they have done it better, Gina? How, obviously, it's a diverse community. How could they have represented it better?
Well, they could have put a professional person, for example, on the show. Most Iranians, by far, the majority of the Iranians of the generation that these characters are from, people in their 30s or early 40s, are professionals. They're artists. They are, a lot of them are techies. And so they could have had one of these guys instead of a bunch of unemployed people who... there's a scene where they're having a small pool party at the house and the entertainment is a huge tiger in a cage. I mean, this is something that would never happen in Los Angeles.
I must leave it there, Gina. As you may say that some people in Los Angeles, regardless of ethnicity, may have a tiger in a cage. You never know. Thank you, Gina Nahai, there. We're going to continue the Los Angeles theme now. We're going to play you the quintessential Los Angeles song. This is Ice Cube with Today Was a Good Day.
Just waking up in the morning, gotta thank God. I don't know, but today seems kinda odd. No barking from the dog, no small. And mama could... Left my homie's house paid.
Oh, that had us dancing then. That was the West Coast of America's legend that is Ice Cube with Today Was a Good Day. Now, in the next half hour, we'll be meeting the neighbours and we'll be taking a culinary tour of Berlin. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much, Christian. The United Nations Syria Special Envoy Kofi Annan has called for an immediate end to violence in the country and stressed that the ultimate solution to the crisis lies in political settlement. Opposition leaders have condemned his call for dialogue with the government of President Bashar al-Assad, saying his comments were disappointing when Syrians were being massacred every day. Moving from Syria to Iran now, and the UN nuclear watchdog believes that Iran may be trying to clean up a military site that inspectors want to visit as part of an investigation into possible Iranian research relevant for atomic bombs. Western diplomats say Iran may be delaying inspectors' access to the Parchin site to give it time to sanitize the facility of any incriminating evidence of explosive tests that would indicate efforts to design nuclear weapons. The daughter of the jailed former Ukrainian Prime Minister Yulia Tymoshenko, Yevgenia, has arrived to visit her mother in prison today following growing concerns about the opposition leader's health. She is serving a 7-year jail sentence for abuse of office following a trial widely seen as a settling of scores between rival groups of influence in the ex-Soviet Republic. The United States and Afghanistan have signed a deal today on the transfer of a major US-run detention centre to Afghan authorities, improving the prospects of a strategic partnership, allowing long-term American involvement in the country. A senior Afghan official said earlier this week that the transfer of the Bagram detention centre would be a first step to handing over all US-managed prisons. And finally, Germany's best-selling Daily has decided to remove its trademark pictures of topless women from the front page in a gesture towards complaining readers. Bild, which sells about 4 million copies a day, will now carry the images on page 3 instead, a format favoured here, of course, by British tabloids. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
Thank you for that very much, Jonathan. Now, it's Friday, and as always, we're joined in the studio by the editor of Monocle's edit section. That's Santiago Tadici. Today is no exception. Santiago, how are you?
Good, great. I couldn't be better with my Peroni beer here.
A beer. You could have brought a German one in.
No, I'm sorry. I when it comes to beer, I stick to Peroni.
Okay, so, you know what you like.
Yeah, exactly.
Did you catch a copy of Bild when you were in Germany?
No, really. Unfortunately, as I heard a minute ago, there are no more nudes. Right?
End of an era on that front.
That's so sad.
How was Berlin?
It was great. I love the city. This was my second time in the German capital.
And what's the food scene like? Because German cuisine has a bit of a bad rap. It's similar to English cuisine is.
But I think the classic version of both German and English cuisine have what you say a bad rap, get a bad rap. But I think there is an evolution taking over the world. So the young chefs are taking over the kitchens, and they're serving organic food and healthy food, locally grown, locally sourced. So I think overall, Berlin is in the same rhythm as the rest of the world when it comes to these culinary trends.
Are there any notable cultural influences in Berlin's food?
I think they still maintain and work and use their traditional ingredients as they've always used. So you will get very, very hearty, very, very filling dishes.
I noticed one of your choice dishes from your trip was, it sounds quite German, wild boar with cabbage.
Yeah, wild boar with cabbage and some potato cutouts that were very good. And before that, as a starter, I had a very hearty, again, vegetable soup with a very tasty herb dumpling in the middle. So you do get those very earthy flavors
that remind foods.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, perfect for winter, or for at least for the end of winter. That was a dinner I had at the Kater Holzig. And I think this is a very good example of what Berlin is. Kater Holzig is in a derelict building and an abandoned
literally an
site.
Empty shell.
Yeah, it's an empty shell full of graffitis and like old furniture and just. I mean, from the outside, I thought I had gone into like a squatter's residence or something.
Does it work though? Once you're sat down.
Once you're there, you get a really nice environment. Mm. You get high end cuisine.
The food is good.
Yeah, you even get like one of those snobbish maître d's like walking.
Really?
Yeah, he was a bit mad at us because we walked in there without a reservation.
How could you?
So he told us off, but in the end.
So you were the squatters in the end.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. Yeah,
quite apt.
So unfortunate, but we were fortunate that after that we had a very nice meal all together.
You've been to pop-up restaurants here in London, which have been held in like motor garages,
exactly.
And not all of them have worked because the food wasn't good. But in this case, the food is what mattered, and it did deliver.
Yeah, it was very good. I think that Berlin is a city that has to be discovered. You can't just turn up there with a guide and just go to these places. It's more about word of mouth
and going off the beaten track.
Yeah, right. definitely, and taking those risks of walking into dark alleys and going down basements and just finding these hidden treasures.
It's not a risk for you. You're a strapping great lad. Did you have a naked lunch? I hear here.
I briefly spoke about that the other day, and although I was still dressed, what was naked was the food again, very very organic produce. Very
and it's called
nice
the Naked ingredients. Lunch. This is the place.
It's called the Naked Lunch, yeah, and it's a new restaurant in almost on the borders of Mitte, and this is a very cool place where the locals go. There's a lot of designers around it, and. And they serve great food for affordable prices. It was four of us had starters, main dishes, beverages, bread, everything, and we paid only like 40-45 euros. That's a bargain.
That's very good.
Yeah.
And lastly, like everywhere else at the moment, coffee culture thriving in Berlin. They're even shipping our favorite beans from Square Mile in London over there.
Yeah, exactly. I think, and that's mainly due to the Australians,
right?
Because I went to this coffee bar called the Barn, and
yes,
so it's hosted by this a guy who I imagine is from Melbourne. He had a very thick Australian accent, and he served some really good coffee, and they're using all of these coffee drip machines, not just the espresso machines, and they serve filtered coffee and so on. And he was with a client, and they were doing like a mini tasting and showing him all the different beans and brews. So So yeah, there's a very strong coffee culture there, definitely.
Speaking of brew, I'll let you get on with your beer. Santiago Taditi, thank you very much for that. We'll be talking about mosques in a moment, but first let's have a song. This Danish three-piece came in last month for a Midori House session. This is Gianna Factory with Rainbow Girl. Rainbow Girl. That was Gianna Factory with Rainbow Girl. It's 41 minutes past the hour here at Midori House. We'll be back in a moment.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, ecclesiastical architecture often pushes boundaries. Think of Le Corbusier's chapel in Ronchamp, one of the 20th century's most iconic buildings. Recently, though, it's mosques that have been the latest divine structure to pique the attention of the architectural community. Islam is the fastest growing religion on earth, and Muslim organizations in Europe and beyond are responding to an urgent need for places of worship. From Cambridge to Cologne, super modern designs are under construction, employing innovative eco-technology and bold modernist designs. And as the furore over the proposal for an Islamic centre near Ground Zero in New York proved, mosques are politically charged structures. Every new building ignites debate in communities as to what Islamic architecture really means. Now, joining me on the line is Paul Böhm, the German architect who designed the vast mosque in central Cologne. Paul, thank you for joining me. Firstly, explain the design and the influences of this mosque.
The influences of the design, I think, we're trying to create an open space for people to pray and to have meditation as well as for all the other people not being Muslims, so that there is an interconnection between all the different cultural directions in the society.
Your father had experience of building cathedrals. Are there similarities in building any type of religious place of worship between a Christian structure or an Islamic one?
I mean, in liturgical aspects, they are quite different. But I think for the meaning of the people going there to pray or to concentrate, meditate by their own or also in the group, in the community, I think there are quite a lot of similarities.
Now, as time goes on and new mosques are built, does the design aspect change, or are there particular requirements and aspects that need to be maintained with all mosques that are built? Have you had any requests for specific requirements with this building?
I don't know if I have any requests, but the design history of mosques is very different from what it was, for example, in churches. I think in building churches, there had been a lot of development in the last 100 years, which is been in mosque design. They are much more traditional and much more looking back into history of mosque architecture. What we are trying to do is to create a new sense of architecture for mosques, and actually not doing a replique of Turkish or Arabian mosques or whatever, but trying to create a European style of mosque architecture.
One of the aspects of the building which has been discussed quite publicly is the size of it. Is there a minimum requirement for the size of the dome? It's a very large dome that we see on this building, and the minarets as well, they're quite large as well. Was that a requirement on this project?
Well, they asked us to have a specialized amount of people praying there. And therefore, we designed the prayer hall. The size of the dome and the minarets are due to the urban space surrounding this plot. So we have, of course, to design a building which is showing what's going on in there. And so we are not trying to hide this structure from its meaning. So I think the idea is that we should all architecture we do in the city should show what it is used for, and so it should be shown that there is a mosque and not a theater or a sports hall or a museum or whatever. So this should be obviously a mosque.
Having an obvious identity is one thing. What about the prominence of the building in the skyline now? I know many people in Cologne had expressed concern that it was too prominent and also visible from the cathedral of the city as well. There's been a lot of debate about this building. It's been quite a contentious issue, hasn't it?
Yeah, there has been a lot of discussion and concern in the very beginning. But I think during the planning and building process, the doubts are getting more quiet. And I think in the moment, I hope it is something connected to the specific design we did, the people are very much getting used to it. And I think it is also because, you know, the structure is very open. We try to bring the urban space into the area. We try to open the prayer hall itself. You know, all the, you see, maybe you saw the pictures. There are those shelves which giving space in between so that you can look into the prayer hall, but also look out of the prayer hall. So that is very open. Everything is very open and transparent. And I think the people, even the non-Muslim people, are going to, yeah, to somehow like the structure and say, well, this is we are not Muslims, but this is our Cologne mosque. So it's something to get. Well, I don't know the English word in the moment. Did somehow get used to it, you know what I mean?
As a non-Muslim yourself, was that an issue when you took on this contract? I understand the bidding process was an open one and that you were awarded this, and many expressed concern that you weren't a Muslim so wouldn't understand what was required with a mosque. Has this project worked in bringing your perspective to the building and its design? And can you see more non-Muslims designing mosques now?
I mean, I mean, I'm an architect, you know. I've been doing churches, I've been doing hospitals, I'm doing offices, I'm doing theaters. Even if I'm not an artist or not an actor or I'm not a dentist or somebody who uses the hospital, for example, or the theater, I have to get used to the needs of the people going into this building afterwards, after it's built, and use it. So this is the same with the mosque, I think. I don't have to be a Muslim to build a mosque, even if I don't have to be a Christ to build a church.
Well, I hope the opening goes well. Paul, we must leave it there. Thank you ever so much for that. That was Paul Bohm, the German architect of the new mosque in central Cologne. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. Now, every week at Monocle, we like to go out and meet our neighbours to get to know some of the thriving local businesses which surround Midori House. This week, we went to Paul Rothen's Son, a traditional deli that sells homemade jams, biscuits, and, of course, where you can have a lovely cup of tea with one of their sandwiches. We spoke to the owner, Paul Roth.
I'm Paul Robert Roth. I'm the grandson of the original Paul Roth, or in German it was called Paul Rother, because he came over from Saxony in 1900. He actually came over in 1898, but he started the shop in 1900. And he started it really just as a German delicatessen. He used to import most of his produce from Germany. And in those days, the shop was purely retail. He'd be serving the local community, their weekly groceries. There weren't any supermarkets in Maribyrn in those days. In fact, my father used to tell me that we were the third delicatessen in London. I don't know whether that's true, but he always told me that story. And then the shop progressed during the Second World War, or just before, we started putting tables and chairs in, and we started doing a little bit of catering on the premises for people that wanted to maybe have a little break from their office. There weren't many places where you could eat a sandwich and have a cup of coffee in those days. The Second World War, my father was by then in the business. My grandfather, the original Paul, he died in 1940, the night that a bomb dropped on Madame Tussauds. My father decided after the war to concentrate more on catering, so we didn't really put the grocery side of things in the forefront. I mean, we still did plenty of grocery, but it wasn't considered our main line of business. And he put tables and chairs as fixed features rather than having freestanding ones. I started work in 1969 after I'd done 2 years as a chef in a training college. And I've seen quite a few changes in that time. I suppose the biggest change I've seen is the restrictive parking. So people can't pull up in their car anymore and do a week's groceries, which really has stopped us being a provider of a week's groceries. Even more now, we're relying on our catering, our sandwiches, our soups and our teas and our coffees. And then what we decided to do about 15 years ago was to concentrate on a few things and specialise in a few retail items. And those things are particularly jams, marmalades and condiments. So people will come from a long way away to buy something unusual, like a medlar jelly, or maybe a very thick caramelised marmalade, like a Tiptree Tawny marmalade. And they'll have interesting choices to make from something like a rose petal jam, any condiment which you might not see in a supermarket. And I think probably my son now has started. He started in 1998, I think it was. So he's been in the shop for about 12 years and he's got his own plans, and he'll probably change the shop a little bit how he wants it in years to come. As far as my perception of Maribyrn, I particularly like its village atmosphere. It's almost cocooned from the outside world. Once you get into Maribyrn, you've got a little Maribyrn village atmosphere, and the other side of Maribyrn Road is different, the other side of Oxford Street is different, the other side of Baker Street is different, and the other side of Tottenham Court Road is different. This little area in between has a charm all of itself.
That was Paul Roth from Paul Roth and Son. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. And we're going to end today's show with a monologue, and our very own Louise Bambury has a slightly unusual take on what should be done about one of London's most iconic landmarks.
It's one of London's most iconic buildings. It's graced album covers and countless moody, urban-themed black and white photographs, and its four towering brick chimneys are recognised all over the world. Now, for the right price, around 380 million euros, it could be yours, because Battersea Power Station is for sale on the open market for the first time. If you happen to be a millionaire in the market for a power station with original Art Deco features, 39 acres of flexible space and fabulous views of the Thames, you would have quite a project on your hands, however. Built in the 1930s by Sir Giles Gilbert Scott, the station finally stopped producing electricity in 1983 and it's lain empty ever since. While a parade of development proposals have fizzled out, either through lack of support or money, you might even say it's jinxed. RIP the proposal by John Broome, the brains behind Alton Towers, to turn it into a theme park. Lack of funding scuppered that one, but not before he'd removed the roof and weakened the structure. Not long afterwards, the chimneys were declared unsafe, raising the probability of knocking them down. The idea of a 305-metre eco-tower was turned down in 2009. The most recent proposal, which was given planning permission, involved a £5.5 billion development of shops, residences and a hotel. The company behind that one went into administration in December last year. Each developer that comes along has a more daunting job as time and the elements take their toll on the building. But if I owned Battersea Power Station, I would give up on the whole idea of development altogether. I'd do precisely nothing. I'd let the falcons carry on nesting in its dangerous chimneys and leave the pigeons to deposit their droppings over the rubbish-strewn corridors. I'd let its carcass slowly crumble picturesquely against the grey British sky. There is, after all, a place in the landscape, if only a small dank corner, for ruins, dereliction and decay. The Victorians, who loved nothing better than a wind-battered ruin, knew that. It speaks of and to our darker side, reminds us of the folly of our aspirations and of our mortality. It fires our imaginations and it inspires the underbelly of culture. While the shiny new art galleries and culture centres echo to the sound of the grown-up and the established, the urban wasteland pulsates to the deep bass of the young, sexy underground. Sadly, I don't have a spare few hundred million to buy my very own ruin. And anyway, I imagine Wandsworth Council won't be happy about it sitting there neglected, hulks of metal and brick falling down from the chimneys while children play in the asbestos below. There is a third way, though. The architect Terry Farrell has come forward with another proposal to restore the chimneys and its Art Deco control rooms and create an urban park on the building's footprint. To me, that sounds like a fitting end to the story. No flashy blocks of flats or insipid retail. It will be accessible and safe, but it will also leave the power station's dignity, heritage and some of its romance intact. Sometimes it's better to leave things more or less alone. For Monocle, this is Louise Banbury.
LDN TYO NYC MT4.
And Battersea Power Station is very iconic. It's actually my desktop wallpaper at the moment on my computer. We're out of time for this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Steve Bloomfield, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. Coming up next is The Menu with Marcus Hippie, and in 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours London time, Tyler Brulé will be here with the Monocle Daily. He'll be joined by Emma Nelson. They'll be covering the latest aviation news in Asia, taking a Friday night tour of Madrid, and getting an update from our correspondent in Jordan. The headlines with Jonathan Wheatley are next, but from all of us here at Midori House, goodbye and have a lovely weekend.